Romans 12 and verse 19. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. For there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore, ye must needs be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. Then turning to Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26. Ephesians 4 and verse 26. Be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil. Amen. We know the Lord will bless the reading of his precious word for his name's sake. Now you remember the last time we focused upon Paul's reference here in this verse 26 of Ephesians 4, in which he is giving guidelines, setting parameters for what is legitimate, lawful anger. And by way of inference, he is also setting in place the prohibition for what is law or what is sinful anger, anger that leads to sinful actions. The situation that readily comes to mind is that of an occasion when someone wrongs another. And that's the context in which Paul is speaking here. He's looking at how we live in society, how we face certain circumstances in society, and sometimes there are circumstances arise in which we are wronged by another person. And the response is that we can become angry, and there are cases where that anger is justifiable. The only case where anger is justifiable is when it is a reaction to sin. That is the only kind of lawful, legitimate, righteous anger where there is that response of anger towards sin. But where anger becomes uncontrolled, it can very quickly lead to the desire for revenge. And that's what Paul is dealing with in Romans chapter 12. He says we are not to avenge ourselves. We are not to take the law into our own hands. And that's something that he emphasizes. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. Note the connection. That anger, if it is uncontrolled, can step outside of the lawful parameters, and it leads to a desire for revenge. And where there is a desire for revenge in the heart, then it's not long until the law is taken into a person's own hands. And Paul is saying that is not open to us. When we are wronged by someone else, we can righteously be angry, but we are not to allow that anger to lead to the desire for revenge. But rather, God has set in place a procedure for revenge. Vengeance belongs to him. It is the Lord's prerogative to right the wrong. The Lord's prerogative. And he has set in place a procedure in order for that to be done. Now, in our English Bible, we have chapter divisions and verse divisions. Remember, in the original scriptures, there were no chapter divisions. And when you're reading this portion in Romans chapter 12, you come to the end of the chapter, and then chapter 13 introduces the subject of civil rulers and the magistrate. Well, you must see the connection here. He is saying, you're not allowed to take the law into your own hands to avenge a wrong that has been done to you, because God has set a procedure in place. The civil ruler, the civil magistrate. And look what he says at the end of verse 4, Romans 13. For he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. That is God's procedure. And that is what the Lord Jesus emphasized in the Sermon on the Mount. We looked at it the last time in Matthew chapter 5, where he quotes from the Old Testament law. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. But I say unto you, love your enemies. If someone smites you on the cheek, turn to him the other cheek. What was the Lord doing? He wasn't setting aside the procedure set in law and in justice. But what he was doing was to correct the abuse that had taken place in Israel. People were taking the law into their own hands. Imagine the situation where two men are in the marketplace and there's an argument develops between the two of them, and one of them smites the other in the cheek. Well, the Lord is saying, in that setting, you're to turn the other cheek. You're not to take the law into your own hands, because the Lord has set in place a procedure for avenging wrongdoing. And that is before the ruler, the civil ruler, and the civil magistrate. He was correcting the abuse of the law. But he recognized and he established the judicial system. This is God's order. The Lord had a procedure for the avenging of evil, for the avenging of wrongdoing. It is given to us in the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel is a pattern for all other nations. Remember how God took Israel into covenant relationship with himself? Israel was established initially as a theocratic nation. God was its king. God had taken Israel into covenant relationship with himself, and the Lord established the pattern for life in the nation. He established two courts. He established an ecclesiastical court, and then he also established a civil court for the affairs of the nation. And the Lord recognized that. You remember in Luke chapter 12, when the Lord tells the parable of the rich farmer, his ground, his goods increased, and he wanted to pull down his barns, build bigger. You know the parable, don't you? Well, that parable was told by the Lord in reference to a question by a man on that occasion. And he said, Lord, my brother is disputing with me about the inheritance. And here was the situation. The father had died. The two brothers are left, and there's a dispute over the inheritance. And the man brings it to the Lord, wanting the Lord to make a judgment on it. And you know what the Lord said? He said, man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? And what he was saying was this: there is a system that God has set in place, a judicial system for the settling of disputes. And when the Lord came, it was not his position, even though he's the king of creation, it was not his task or his role to fill the office of the civil judge, the civil magistrate. The Lord was saying, that can be sorted out in the court system. The Lord had established this process. And that's how evil and wrongdoing is to be avenged. We're not to take the law into our own hands. We may be justly incensed when we are wronged. We may have a legitimate anger, but that anger must not become the desire for revenge. And furthermore, it must not lead into seeking to take the law into our own hands. There is a procedure in place. And what the Lord set in place for Israel is to be the pattern for all other nations. What is that pattern? Well, that's the pattern that I want us to look at briefly today. Because when you look at the history of Israel, you'll find that the Lord appointed persons, certain persons, as judges. You go away back to Exodus chapter 18, and on that occasion, we are informed of the Israelites coming out of Egypt and they're being established as a nation. And Moses is sitting as the judge. He's listening to every case of controversy, every dispute. His father-in-law comes and he's observing this. And he says to his son-in-law Moses, he said, "This is not good. You're going to wear yourself out and you're going to wear the people out, because the burden is too great." And so Jethro gives Moses advice. And he says to him in Exodus chapter 18, he says in verse 21, "Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens, and let them judge the people at all seasons. And it shall be that every great matter they shall bring on to thee, but every small matter they shall judge. So shall it be easier for thyself, and they shall bear the burden with thee." This was Jethro's advice to Moses. Set in place a system of judges. A judge over 10, and then a judge over 50, and over 100, and over 1,000. Set in place this system of judges who will deal with all these disputes, and the disputes that are too great, too difficult, then they can bring them to you. And you can be the one who approaches God to find the determination. Well, Moses felt the burden of that position in Numbers chapter 11. He complains of the great weight that was upon him because of this. Numbers 11 and verse 14, and he says, "I am not able to bear all this people alone because it's too heavy for me." And the Lord said unto Moses, "Gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom thou knowest to be the elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them unto the tabernacle of the congregation, that they may stand there with thee." And we find on this occasion Moses feeling the weight, and the Lord gives direction now for the establishing of this court. If you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 1, Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse number 9. Moses is rehearsing that occasion. He says, "I speak unto you at that time, saying, I am not able to bear you myself alone. The Lord your God hath multiplied you, and behold, ye are this day as the stars of heaven for multitude." Verse 12. "How can I myself alone bear your cumbrance and your burden and your strife? Take you wise men and understanding and knowing among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. And ye answered me and said, the thing which thou hast spoken is good for us to do. So I took the chief of your tribes, wise men and known, and made them heads over you, captains over thousands, and captains over hundreds, and captains over fifties, captains over tens, and officers among your tribes." He's establishing this procedure. You don't take the law into your own hand when you feel grieved or aggrieved by what someone else has done. There's this process where there will be a hearing of disputes and judges who will give their verdict in the matter according to the law. This was God's procedure. And when you study the nation of Israel, when you study their background, you will find that there were two courts, one ecclesiastical, one civil. The ecclesiastical dealt with the affairs of the church. The civil dealt with the affairs of the nation. If you take a little time and read Jeremiah chapter 26, you'll find there that the chief priests in the ecclesiastical court when they heard what Jeremiah was preaching, they didn't like it, and they said, this man's worthy of death. They wanted to put him to death, accusing him of being a false prophet. Well, then the princes, they heard of it, and they came, and they sat in judgment, and they said, this man is not worthy of death. There were two courts, ecclesiastical and civil. And you can trace that. I recommend you to get George Gillespie's book, Aaron's Rod Blossoming. George Gillespie was one of the Scottish commissioners in the Westminster Assembly. He was a young man. He died at 36, but he was referred to as the Prince of Scottish Theologians. And in that book, Aaron's Rod Blossoming, he shows how Israel had the two different courts, one ecclesiastical and one civil. And he explains the difference between the two, and he shows this was the procedure. This was the procedure. Men could not take the law into their own hands. And where there is no rule of law, where there's no system of justice, every man ends up doing whatever's right in his own eyes. And before long, society disintegrates into chaos. This was the Lord's pattern. Persons were appointed as judges. And then as you study the matter further, you'll find that there were penalties applied. Penalties applied in certain circumstances. Those penalties fall into three categories. The first is compensatory, where there were certain disputes, the penalty would be a financial penalty. A person would have to pay. If he stole a sheep, for instance, he would have to pay back four other sheep. If a man was injured and he lost time, then, according to Exodus 21, verse 18 and 19, then the offender would have to pay for the loss of his time. That's what you categorize as compensatory penalties. And then there were corporal penalties, punishments upon the body. Deuteronomy 25, verse 1 to 3, scourging for certain crimes. And then you have the third category, which is capital penalties, the death penalty. And when you read through the judicial laws given to Israel, the death penalty was imposed for murder. That's Exodus 21, verse 12. For man-stealing, Exodus 21, verse 16. For improper disrespect, the same chapter, verse 17. For witchcraft, Exodus 22, verse 18. For bestiality, same chapter, verse 19. Idolatry, verse 20 of that chapter. Sabbath breaking, Exodus 31, verse 14. And for false prophets, Deuteronomy 13, verse 5. And contumacy against the law, Deuteronomy 17, verse 12 to 13. These penalties were given. They were imposed. In some cases, in relation to capital penalty, the capital penalty of death, there could be satisfaction by another kind. In Exodus 21, verse 28, we read of this example. If an ox gore a man or a woman that they die, then the ox shall be surely stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. But if the ox were wont to push with his horn in time past, and it hath been testified to his owner, and he hath not kept him in, but that he hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. So if a man had an ox, and he was informed, your ox is loose, and your ox has attacked someone else, or it has been troublesome, if he has failed to restrain, and the ox attacked another person and killed him, then the owner was placed under the death penalty. But in this circumstance, satisfaction could be made in another way. Verse 30, if there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatsoever is laid upon him. But in the case of murder, there was no exception. No exception. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 35. Numbers chapter 35. These are the penalties that were given. The Lord established the penalties. In verse number 30, Deuteronomy 35, whoso killeth any person, the murderer shall be put to death by the mouth of witnesses. But one witness shall not testify against any person to cause him to die. Moreover, ye shall take no satisfaction for the life of a murderer which is guilty of death, but he shall be surely put to death. There was no mitigating circumstance in the case of murder. There was no alternative penalty. An eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. And Paul says in Hebrews 10, verse 29, when he quotes from the Old Testament laws, he says they died without mercy. Without mercy. There was no mercy. There was no relaxing of the capital penalty for murder. In God's theocratic nation with Israel, these penalties were set in place. The persons appointed to act as judges, and they were given the penalties, either compensatory or corporal or capital. But the Lord also set in place the procedure that they were to follow, clear guidelines. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse number 16. Deuteronomy 1 and verse 16. This is where this system is being set up now. And clear guidelines, procedures are set in place. Moses said, I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother, and the stranger that is with him. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of man, for the judgment is God's. And the cause that is too hard for you, bring it on to me, and I will hear it. Now you'll notice, this is the procedure. And where there is a dispute between neighbor and neighbor, they could not take the law into their own hands. They could not exact revenge themselves. There was this system of judgment. And it was a thorough system. The judges are described as those who hear. Did you see that in verse 16? Hear the causes. Verse 17, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. If it's too hard, bring it on to me and I will hear it. The purpose of the judge was not to be a prosecutor. He was to listen. And where there was this dispute between two people, one who is the accuser, the other who is the accused, they are to come before the judge and they are to present their case. And the judge's priority was to listen, to hear the matter. Moses is establishing the principle of fairness. Fairness. A man cannot be condemned or punished until he is given a fair trial, until his side is listened to. There is to be this inquiry. The judge is to find out the truth between the two men. No man appeared before the judge as guilty until his case was heard. And the judge was to be impartial. Ye shall not respect persons. And the judge was protected. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of man. This position of the judge was protected from intimidation. Now, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 16. Deuteronomy chapter 16. Remember, we're looking at this because this is the reason why we do not allow righteous anger to exact revenge from the person that has wronged us. This is the procedure the Lord has set in place. Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 18. Judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee throughout thy tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. If you and I were reading this in the Hebrew language, it would be read like this. They shall judge the people with justice, justice. It's what's referred to as the double emphasis. The word is used twice. And what it means here, the emphasis is the judgment is to be perfect. It is to be just, perfect justice. They shall judge the people with justice, justice. It must be safeguarded. This is the role and the requirement. Verse 19, thou shalt not rest or twist judgment. Thou shalt not respect persons, neither take a gift to be bribed. For a gift doth blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. That which is altogether just shalt thou follow. This is the sense here. Again, it's used the double emphasis. That which is altogether just, justice, justice, shalt thou follow, that thou mayest live and inherit the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Now come into chapter 17 of Deuteronomy. And here we have an illustration given. If there be found, verse 2, if there be found among you any within any of thy gates which the Lord thy God giveth thee, man or woman, which hath wrought wickedness in the sight of the Lord thy God, in transgressing his covenant, and hath gone and served other gods and worshipped them, either the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, and it be told thee, and thou hast heard of it, and inquired diligently, and behold, it be true, and the thing certain, that such abomination is wrought in Israel, then shalt thou bring forth that man or that woman which hath committed that wicked thing onto the gates, even that man or that woman, and shall stone them with stones that they die. Notice the precision of the procedure. It be told thee, you've heard of it, you have inquired diligently, proven it to be true, and it's certain beyond all doubt. Beyond all doubt. Only then was the sentence to be passed and the penalty, the punishment, to be executed. That's where we get the saying that a man or woman is innocent until proven guilty. This was the procedure God set in place. It's meant to be the system that exists in our nation. But sad to say, and while I'm not against a free press, I think the press in a number of areas has overstepped the mark. And while the press should be there to report, it can very easily usurp the role of the judge, the court system of justice. And what we have ended up seeing is people tried in or by the press. And in that setting, they never get a fair hearing. Look at how strict and how precise the instructions were concerning this system of the judiciary, the office of the judge, the penalties, and the procedure. The judge was to hear both sides, inquire and establish the truth of the matter beyond all doubt. And only then was the sentence to be passed. There was a procedure for witnesses. Look at verse 6 of that chapter. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. But at the mouth of one witness shall he not be put to death. No man could be executed or receive the death penalty on the basis of only one witness. Here there is a safeguarding. There must be at least two or three witnesses. And we're told there in verse 7, the hands of the witnesses shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people. There was a court of appeal. Verse 8 of that chapter, if there arise a matter too hard for thee in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, between stroke and stroke, being matters of controversy within thy gates, then shalt thou arise and get thee onto the place which the Lord thy God shall choose. And thou shalt come unto the priests, the Levites, and unto the judge that shall be in those days, and inquire, and they shall show thee the sentence of judgment. There's the twofold systems. The priests and the Levites, they belong to the ecclesiastical court. And then the judges belong to the civil court. And where there were matters in a district that were too hard for the district judge, they were then referred to as what we might refer to as the Supreme Court. And that was the court of appeal, the final court of appeal. Verse 11, according to the sentence of the law which they shall teach thee, and according to the judgment which they shall tell thee thou shalt do, thou shalt not decline from the sentence which they shall show thee to the right hand or to the left. It was the final court of appeal. Cases that were extremely difficult were referred to the higher court appointed by the Lord. You can see that these procedures are thorough, stringent, exhibiting a careful and exact method for establishing the truth. And only when the truth was established was the consequence then applied. And that was to ensure that an innocent person would not be wrongly accused or punished. If you look at Deuteronomy chapter 19, Deuteronomy chapter 19, in verse number 16, if a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges, depending what the circumstances were, if it was ecclesiastical or if it was civil. Verse 18, and the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness is found to be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you. False witness was evil in the sight of God, and it was punishable upon being proven. You can see these procedures that the Lord set in place, very strict and stringent. We're not to take the law into our own hands. There is a procedure set in place. It must be thorough, exact. The judge listens to all sides and determines what the truth is. And only then is the proper sentence carried out. Now that raises principles for us today, because what we read here in the Old Testament in the case of Israel was a pattern which is to be applied today. It highlights in the first place that society is to be governed by the rule of law. Man needs to be governed by true and just laws for the well-being of society. These scriptures are teaching us the existence of evil doing. And that evil doing comes from the fallen nature of man. And because man is a fallen sinner, it is necessary for the well-being of society to have a judicial system in place to protect the righteous and to punish the evildoer and to restrain evil. That's the teaching of the Bible. When you look at these procedures, it highlights that all men are equal under the law. The judge was not to have any respect of persons. He was to listen to the small and the great. No favoritism. Nobody favored above another, depending on his station in life, depending on how much money he had. The judge was to be impartial, because all men are equal under the law, whether great or small. And all men are equally responsible to the law. All men are to be given a fair hearing. A fair hearing. If you turn to Acts chapter 23, you find that case where Paul is brought before the Jewish council, the Jewish Sanhedrin. And remember, at that point in time, the sovereign authority of the nation of Israel had been taken away. They were under the government of the Roman Empire. Now, the Romans allowed the ecclesiastical court to continue, the Sanhedrin, but Rome exercised justice for the civil affairs. And here we have a case where Paul is brought before the Jewish Sanhedrin, and in this instance, he doesn't receive fairness. And you can see that in verse 1. Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by to smite him on the mouth." So no sooner does he open his mouth, but he's smitten. And that's an indication that they were not prepared to listen to what Paul had to say. He wasn't going to be given a fair hearing. That was the requirement in both the ecclesiastical and the civil courts. The judge shall hear. Hear. And they smote him on the mouth. There was an uproar. The Roman captain came in order to settle the uproar. He took Paul into custody, and then there was a plot to kill Paul by the Jews. It was made known to the captain, so he sent him away to Felix at Caesarea. And Felix listens to the case, and how different it is when you look at the opportunity that Paul had before a Roman governor. The Roman governor allowed Paul to speak and put his case. The Roman governor thought he might get out of it if he says to Paul, "Well, will you not go back to Jerusalem to the council there to be tried?" And Paul realized, "I'm not going to get a fair trial there." So he appealed to Caesar. Acts 25 and verse 10. "Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged." Paul recognized the legitimacy of the civil court. And he says, "To the Jews I have done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender, or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die." He accepted the system. And he says, "If I have done something guilty of the death penalty, then I submit to that." But you see, the Jews were wanting to kill him, and they weren't going to give him a fair trial. They smote him in the mouth as soon as he started to speak. And so he appeals to Caesar. "But if there be none of these things whereof they accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar." He's emphasizing the fact that all men are equal under the law. And if a man is accused, he has the right to be heard. And no sentence can be passed upon him until his guilt is proven. The judges were appointed by God, and they were appointed by God to act on God's behalf. Romans 13, he is the minister of God. 2 Chronicles 19, verse 5 and 7, ye judge not for man, but for the Lord. They were to judge according to God's standard. And their judgments had to be just, fair. The punishment had to fit the crime. That's why the law said eye for an eye. You can't take away a man's life if the injury has only been for an eye. And what that is saying is that the punishment must fit the crime. It must be fair. It must be proportionate. Now the Lord set in place this procedure because justice must put away evil from a society and thereby prevent divine judgment falling on that nation. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 21, and here we have an interesting case. It refers to a situation that happened in the day of King Saul, but it's not mentioned during Saul's life. It's only now in 2 Samuel chapter 21. And it tells us, it informs us that Saul had slain the Gibeonites. Now, the Gibeonites descended from the Amorites. And way back in the days of Joshua, they actually deceived Joshua. They led on to be people who they were not. Joshua entered into a league with them, thinking that they lived very far away from Israel, when in fact they actually lived right there in their midst. He entered into a league with them. He made a covenant with them that he would not harm them. And then they afterwards discovered who they were. But because that covenant had been made by Joshua, they were obliged to live by that covenant. But when Saul came along, King Saul slew the Gibeonites. And it goes unnoticed until we come to 2 Samuel 21, and we read in verse 1, there was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year. And David struggled by this, and he inquires of the Lord. He says, Lord, what's the meaning of this? Why is this famine here in the land? Why is the land suffering? And the Lord said, it is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites. You see, the Lord had taken note of it, this murder. The Lord had taken note of it. It had not been avenged in the right way. It had not been dealt with. But the blood of the innocent was crying to God, who is the avenger of all evil. And the Lord sent the famine upon the nation because the crime, the sin, had not been avenged. And when David finds out the reason of it, David brings the Gibeonites and he says, what shall we do? And they said, we don't want silver or gold. Neither shall you kill any man in Israel, but the man that consumed us, verse 5, the man that consumed us and that devised against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the coasts of Israel, let 7 men of his sons be delivered unto us, and we will hang them up unto the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord did choose. And David complied, life for life. And only when those sons of Saul were executed, verse 14, the last part of the verse says, and after that, God was entreated for the land. The judgment upon the land was lifted when justice was executed, when the sin had been purged. That's why this is very important. This is the procedure. We do not take the law into our own hands. There is a procedure God has set in place. 1 Corinthians 6, Paul deals there with small matters that arise between believers, and he said those should not be taken to the civil court. Small matters. But he wasn't abolishing the civil court. He himself appealed to Caesar's court. But what he is doing, and what the scripture does, is to show that God's procedure must be followed. It affects a nation. It affects a society where sin is not dealt with in the right way. We cannot take this into our own hands. We are not to avenge ourselves, because the Lord has appointed avengers. And that vengeance only comes after due process. A fair hearing where guilt is established beyond all doubt. And only then the penalty is administrated. Now, when you look at this, it applies to the world today because man is sinful. But it also has a future application. It tells us what it's going to be like when the Lord comes back. And when the Lord comes back as the great judge, he will purge the world of all evil. His kingdom will be established upon righteousness. And flowing out of that righteousness will be perfect peace and joy. As believers, as Christians, we should be concerned with what happens in our land. We should pray that those who are in authority, who make laws, who sit in state, who are involved in matters of justice and judgment, that they will be godly, that they will follow the Lord, and that they will do what's right in the sight of God. And as Christians, we should do everything in our power to vote such people into those positions. And we should do everything in our power legitimately to prevent people who are the very opposite from being in those positions. That's what this is teaching us. But it is also emphasizing that our great hope, while we live in a world that's full of evil, where justice is very often perverted, neglected, twisted, it reminds us that we should not despair, because there is coming a day when the great King shall come, and His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and it shall be established upon righteousness, justice, and flowing out of that, perfect peace for his people, for the citizens of his kingdom. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. And if that vengeance is not repaid through the appointed procedure in the civil court, in the state, then our hope is the day when the King shall come. If vengeance is not executed upon evil doing in this life, in this world, it will be when Jesus comes again. That's our hope. That's our confidence. The coming of our great King.